Talk given Saturday, 14th July, 1973. Let us first consider today something of freedom within ourselves. From the time we are born, we are conditioned by all the influences around us. We say that we are a body-mind organism or a psychophysical being. The physical aspect of it we understand fairly well. The psychical, mental aspect is still something of which we are very ignorant. Remember this, that the physical body consists of what we commonly call matter. It is a specialized pattern of matter made out of the universal matter that is spread throughout the cosmos. The same elements, the same energies, electrical or heat or chemical or whatever it is, they all operate in each of us as a physical living pattern. The psychical aspect, the mental aspect, similarly, is our particular pattern of mental expression out of the universal mind which pervades the whole cosmos. This is something we forget all the time, and we certainly live, our lives are the perfect evidence that we don't know anything about this at all. We say my feelings, my thoughts, my desires, as if they were particular separate possessions, exclusively our own. Nothing of the sort. Just as the air we breathe is the universal air around us, we can't pick and choose which oxygen or nitrogen, etc., we shall breathe in, and what will happen to the air we breathe out. We simply cannot choose where the mind is concerned. Out of the universal stock of which is mind, this unknown mystery, there take place processes which we call mental and psychical processes. And purely out of convenience, we may say, my mind. But in actual fact, there is no such thing as my mind. This vast universal mind energy, meeting body in the human being, in living creatures, gives rise to what we call psyche. Psyche and mind are not identical. Psyche specifically distinguishes the pattern which you yourself display of this universal thing which is mind. Just as your own particular body is the physical pattern which you display out of this universal thing which is matter. See it clearly that way. Now, what is one of the extraordinary aspects of this mysterious reality which we name mind? It is immeasurable. It is indefinable. We can't hold it. We don't really, as to use the common word, know what it is. It is in its natural, fundamental state, absolutely perfect, it is at peace, it is quiescent, it is alive in a mental sense, not in our biological sense merely. It is very much alive. It is quiescent, poised, dynamic, active. The paradox. But there it is. It's all that. It's the great mystery. And this mystery enters into our being and makes itself at least slightly apparent to us in those moments when we ourselves are in the state of poise, of inward poise and quiet. Now, what distinguishes our, what is it that distinguishes our state of unquiet, our lack of poise? It is the continuous flow of discursive thought, of silent chatter in the brain. You look at your mind. Just watch yourself whilst you are awake. That brain never stops chattering. None of the monkeys can compete with us where that is concerned. There is this incessant, perpetual chatter. Consider what this chatter is made up of. First and foremost, it is totally centered around the word I. That marvelous misperception of the true nature of our being, the word I and its associations in our own mind. It's centered around all that. Next, all this chattering is confined to words which express that which is stored up in the deep well of the unconsciousness in terms of sight impressions, sound impressions, touch impressions, and so forth. In other words, the impressions we receive through our senses. Now, the impressions which we receive through our senses, in the first instance, are absolutely pure and true impressions. But within a fraction of a second, they are spoiled. How are they spoiled? From birth onwards, all these impressions, which at first are only percepts and not concepts at all, are only percepts, are gradually given names. That's to say, words are used, sounds are used, in whatever your particular language may be, to name that percept, to name the sensation. And so, you see, the thing in itself recedes into the background and the concept begins to take its place. But the concept is an image. It's an image made by my brain in what I commonly call my mind. This image-making faculty characterizes us, and the images are made out of the mental material which we receive through our senses. Now you see the point. There is only a certain limited amount of mental material which comes into us. That which comes into us through our particular senses. This living organism, the human being, is restricted to that. Nature has made him so, he can't escape that fact. Supposing we had 20, 100 different senses, good heavens, think of the oceans of impressions that would be flowing into us. Something quite different. Now, just with these few senses that we have, these images are made in the mind and they are named. And the brain's activity is ceaseless. It goes on chattering away all the time with these restricted things. And the images which we make falsify the actual reality of the thing in itself. The thing in itself, the event in itself, the person in himself or herself, I don't know. I only know my particular image of it. And my brain keeps chattering and playing about with the thing, you know, all the time. Now, this is the meaning, or at least one great meaning, of the word Maya, which we use in India, meaning illusion. These images are partly, in fact, very considerably false representations, representations of the reality. You see? It's a curious thing that even in India, where they did know something about this to start with, they have made curious mistakes, and they have said that the whole world is an illusion. No, nothing is an illusion. There is the one total reality, which is no illusion at all. But my image of it is an illusory image. This is what we must bear in mind. That the way we are conscious of the world, is an illusory way. There are flaws in the images in our mind. Considerable flaws. Now, to make the situation far more complex and difficult, I shouldn't say complex, a complex thing can be perfect, in perfect working order, complicated and difficult, there is the intrusion of desire. Desire bedevils the whole situation. And that desire, again, the formulated desire is the brain's interpretation of the natural, physical, electrochemical processes in the living body. The structure of the living body, your particular brain and nerves and ductless glands and blood and everything, all that is responsible for the particular formulation of your desires and your drives, together with all the forces around, parents, friends, teachers, education, culture, the actual material and historical situation, all these condition the form which that desire takes. So you see how unfree we are. How bound we are. Now one has to see this very, very clearly. Be careful. Do not think that to see clearly means to give an absolutely accurate analysis. Such a thing is not possible at all. Who is the analyzer? The conditioned, deluded mind. That is the analyzer. So you see, you have to bear that in mind. Now, bearing that in mind, we see that the process of seeing clearly means that we have to remain open-minded, totally open-minded, and as quiet as possible. Because then, the succession of stimuli and impulses which come to us from outside or emerge from within us, have a chance of making something like a true impression. And gradually, we begin to see the flaws, the falsities of our own thinking process, our feeling process, and so on. And as this goes on, this chattering begins to calm down. It really begins to calm down. Then You are in a state of observation. You don't go floundering about wildly searching for the truth. If you just keep quiet, the truth will make itself apparent. Because you don't have to go there to find truth. It is right here. And the very fact that I struggle to go there creates such a swirl that I fail to see the truth. You are like a crazy coot who is in the company of 100 lovely girls, one of whom is your sweetheart, and you go rushing about amongst all of them, "Where's my sweetheart? Where's my sweetheart?" And of course you miss her. Just be quiet, and very soon, before you know where you are, you will see each other. That's all. Be sensible. The most difficult thing in the world, to be sensible. So now you see, all this causes the disturbance. The religious disciplines of the world, which are concerned with getting us out of this mess, with disentangling us from this state of cruel entanglement, have given certain general directions, suggestions, shall I say, that would be better, certain suggestions as to how one might see one's way through this maze. And I want to read you something, just a few sentences from this book, Tibetan Yoga and Secret Doctrines, which has the translation of several Tibetan texts. And this particular text is called The Nirvanic Path, dealing with the subject of concentrating the mind. It says, there are three processes involved in concentrating the mind. The instantaneous cutting off of a thought at the root, the very moment it arises. Second, leaving unshaped whatever concept or idea appears. Third, letting the mind assume its natural condition. Note, its natural condition of absolute quiescence. Condition which is the perfect condition, the universal condition. It is, in fact, the nirvanic condition, where no ill is present or can penetrate. Now, first and foremost, this idea, this statement about concentration of the mind. Concentration is a bad word. One immediately thinks in terms of constriction, of shutting out, of excluding everything excepting that which you concentrate upon. But universal mind itself is not like that. It is universal mind. There is nothing excluded in it. The Sanskrit word used is ekagrata, and the other word is samadhi. Samadhi is the word usually translated as concentration, which it isn't. Samadhi really is the complete togetherness. Ekagrata is translated as one-pointedness. No. Ekagrata really is, in actual fact, the being unified. We talked a little bit about the various senses. Now, if you watch your mental processes for even 5 minutes, you will see how all the different sense consciousnesses, that is to say, the eye conscious, the sight consciousness, the touch consciousness, etc., they all clamor for supremacy as far as your attention is concerned. You know, they're like children in the classroom who shout out, "Sir, sir, sir," everyone clamoring for attention. It's somewhat like that. Now, in that state, the mind is in disorder. But when that is quietened down, the mind is in a unified condition. It is not exclusive in any respect. Ekagrata, made one. In that sense, if you translate the English term, one-pointed, in that sense, you've got the right sense of it. See, the mind is unified, and in that unified state, it is possible to realize the complete togetherness. In other words, you may use the English word communion, which is far nearer the reality of samadhi. Total communion. The isolative, separative self-consciousness has ceased to cut you off from the totality. You are in full relationship with it, in harmony with it, whatever the total reality may be. It's not necessary at all to know it analytically or in words. This sensitivity within the living being, which is pure awareness, is now functioning utterly freely, unhindered, unobstructed by all the intellectual chatter that goes on inside one. Do you get the idea? You get it? That is pure awareness, and that is the state of samadhi. So now, this is what he is referring to when he talks of concentrating and so forth. And he says the instantaneous cutting off, first and foremost, instantaneous cutting off of a thought at the root, the very moment it arises. The Upanishads talk about it. The Muktika Upanishad, Mukti means liberation, the liberated state and so forth. You see, that Upanishad talks about it and says, the moment an idea arises, destroy the mind. And of course, anybody reading that feels a bit terrified. Or if he doesn't feel terrified, he says, this is very funny. How do you destroy the mind? See? Now, the second and the third follow from the first, actually. So let us look into this first aspect. The cutting off of a thought the instant it arises. Can you do it? You will only find that you have replaced it by another thought. You can't cut off the thinking process. Just as you cannot and should not stop the flowing of the blood throughout the body. Otherwise, you'll die. It's the same with the thought process, the mental activity. But you see, there is a right and a healthy flow, and there is the unhealthy flow which produces the disturbed state, the unhappy state, the ill state, dukkha, as we say in Buddhist terms, bandha, as we say in Hindu terms, bondage in straightforward English. You see, misery. The awareness of the pain of the absence of communion. Now, it might be best that we go into this in a practical manner, somewhat similar to what we did at our last meeting in connection with similar things. So let the body be perfectly poised, comfortably, sit quite comfortably at ease, and let all strains and stresses just fall away. Breathe comfortably. And see that all tension, first in the abdominal region, releases. This is where one gets tight first. And the pelvic region. Let the movement of the diaphragm as you breathe in and out be perfectly rhythmic and gentle. It's not a case of breathing deeply or anything like that. Just breathe naturally. Let your own life rhythm establish itself. And you will notice, you may notice, that as that life rhythm establishes itself, the discursive thought process in the brain quietens down. The state of tenseness in the psyche gives place to a state of ease. And this, if properly done, is a real ease and not a case of self-hypnosis. You are really at ease in the psyche. When one is really at ease, psychophysically as a whole, then it is possible for this extraordinary faculty which we human beings possess of paying attention can operate without obstruction. Now one can fruitfully pay attention to the thought process. Just watch the flow of thought through the mind. It may be a logical stream of thought, or it may be just haphazard. One flits from some sight impression to a touch impression, to a memory, to anything. Now just cotton on, hold hard to any one particular impression or thought as it arises, right now. And let us look at it quite steadily. This particular thought, keep the set of words which is the verbal expression of that thought. Keep the set of words clearly in your mind. Really hold on to them. And examine which sense impression has played the dominant part in that particular set of words. Are they concerned with something you have seen, touched, heard, whatever it is? Now, as you look at it, do not pass judgment on it. Neither approval nor disapproval, and above all, be as free as possible from all attachment or aversion from that particular thought or sense function. Just look at it. Look at it not merely coldly, intellectually, but with as warm a sensitivity as you are capable of. By that I do not mean any emotional upset. Watch carefully, I can't bear it, or oh, isn't it awful, or isn't it wonderful, and get caught up in an ecstasy, because they're all disturbing factors. But with a warm sensitivity, which has no words or analysis involved in it, plus the cool, intellectual, analytical perception at the same time. Now just hold that for a few moments. Some of us may find difficulty in holding it. It slips away, or other thoughts intrude. They intrude, pushing this first thought out, somewhat after the fashion of a crowd behind one, which pushes one along in a certain direction, willy-nilly. Something like that sometimes. But just observe what happens. Next, observe the quality of that particular thought. What does it express? What is it derived from? Is it related to the activity of ambition or greed or annoyance or depression? Or a mood of exaltation, or vanity, or conceit, or whatever it is inside me. Just observe what is its root. And in this observation, we may discover that ignorance and the pleasure drive are two of the most powerful factors in this movement of all our discursive thought. What is the significance of this? Is it not very simply that we are all self-centered . All the pleasure drive is for the sake of the self, that is to say, the separate self, the self cut off from the totality. It is not too difficult to see that, but it is rather difficult to see the real meaning of the word ignorance, avidya, in this context. Ignorance means the state of unawakenedness, of unawareness of the nature, the immensity, the fullness, as well as the voidness of the totality. This is the important point. This is ignorance. And you see, being unawakened to totality, to the whole reality, all sorts of thoughts and feelings just arise, which are self-oriented and which express the disturbance of the mind. They express the non-unified, disharmonious state, which is the ill state, the subhuman state. But the moment there is some sort of quiescence and harmony throughout the psychophysical organism, the flow of discursive thought, which will naturally take place, will be seen like a river flowing past, with yourself sitting quietly on one of the banks, looking at it. Notice the whole phenomenon very carefully. Now, beware of wishing to change the phenomenon, wishing it otherwise. I wish I were harmonious, unified, etc. All that is useless. Not only useless, but the wish in itself, desire, is self-oriented. And this exclusive self is the very devil in us. Try and be aware as sensitively as possible and in a state of as perfect a poise as possible as you hear the words. Be very sensitive to them. That is the important thing. Otherwise, the brain, with its usual superficiality, will just set up a whole lot of concepts . The outward skin of the potato, the peelings, and preserve them and throw away the potato. Be sensitive, therefore, to it. Then you get to the heart of the thing. And thereby understand this curious state of ignorance in which we are all caught up. This is the great darkness through which every individual has to find his own way out. When I say own way, I mean the way out through his own rightly directed effort. What the Buddha calls samma vayamo, perfect endeavor. Not misdirected endeavor, and all endeavor directed towards obtaining for the separate self, whether it be a meal or whether it be nirvana, is a misspent effort.